Bulls are not on parade. It's Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. This is Overtime. I'm your host, Chris Vecchio, the man in orange. Ilya Spivak, the man in blue. Dylan Radigan. We're all back together. It's been over a week. Good to see you both. Dylan, a lot's changed since the last time you and I crossed paths. Good. The market's about 3.5% lower, and you're back on the bear train.
I'm back on the bear train. I'm finally getting to sell some of my call spreads. I also like the oil short position. Oil didn't even rally in the face of the Iranian apocalypse. If it can't rally an Iranian apocalypse, what can it do? So I figure oil's going lower. The equities obviously are of the weak hand. And, you know, I don't think I'm saying anything that is extraordinary. The question that I was having with Victor and Ilya yesterday was not even so much directional sentiment, which is almost, at this point, it's very hard to argue against some degree of either neutrality or pessimism, and more an exploration of the most efficient ways to put positions on to try to benefit from it, which I'm interested to talk to you about, assuming you're not in a reversal position, which I know you're not, because you just said as much in the last few minutes with Tom and Tony. So, you know, yeah. And for me, it's put spreads in oil, or excuse me, call spreads on the NASDAQ and oil, but very interested in your perspective on the most effective instruments here, if you want to be on the pessimistic side as far as price levels are concerned.
Sure. Well, right as we get there, though, let's talk about these equity markets today. The S&P 500 is now down by, I see here, 0.26%. Not a huge loss on the session. We see here that the Dow Jones off by, actually up now by 0.16%. NASDAQ up by 0.02. Russell down by 0.45. Dylan, you know, I just wrote this up for the Tasty Live Traders blog. I see one of two things here. We were looking at that 51.60 level or so last week, measured against the high of 53.33.5. And that gave us basically a 167 point move, a measured target that would bring you to 5,000.25 if you ultimately started to break down. And it's hard to argue that you didn't get that on Friday. Maybe the initial move into support, that 21.34 EMA envelope, it did hold up for a few days. You know, you had the back and forth price action for 5 or 6 days, but it was never one of those quick bounces like we had seen previously. So Friday, I cut everything. I have no reason to be long here. We're going into weekend event risk. I'm not going to be able to manage my book the rest of Friday because I'm meeting up with the Tasty Live team in the city. So I took my lumps. The positions I put back on at the start of April, the long call spreads, I had to get out of. Now, granted, the market's now 100 points, over 100 points lower than where I exited. So I'm grateful that I was able to get out when I could. So I'm facing one of two questions right now as someone who still thinks that this market has some room to run to the upside this year for a myriad of reasons, all of which I've articulated. But even seasonally, when do stocks rally in April? April 16th onwards. So I can't really toss in the towel from a seasonal basis as someone who believes in that stuff. But I'll go over to the 8-hour time frame here. And this to me is indicative of the kind of market that we're in right now, why I'm not ready to call a bottom just yet. We have these former highs in February up near 51.25. And once we punch through them, they quickly become support through the end of the month and the beginning of March. And these last few hours, when we go down to this hourly time frame, you could see that we're just not able to clear that threshold, this blue line horizontally cutting across the screen. As Ilya likes to point out so often, the horizontal absolute price levels probably matter more to everyone because they're objective and agreeable, whereas anything that's diagonal is more subjective and left up to the eye of the beholder, essentially. Mm-hmm. But this is a pretty clear level I'm seeing here. It was a former yearly high. It was former support once we broke through it. And now here, after having cleared it out just yesterday, we've struggled all day to get back over it. So
bumping and can't do it.
And a big rejection into the close, mind you. So, I mean, this to me is actually a pretty definable range here. If I'm not in the market right now and I'm looking for short term through the end of the week, I think you actually got a pretty good trade setup right now because we have an equidistant range that's just over, we'll call it 40 points. And so if we get above 51.25, bulls have a short-term bottom to work with. We've now gotten back above a key level. Volatility's high, so I can look at the 67.8 IVR and say, you know what, maybe a 5,000 put spread here. I could sell one of those and that might work. I could do maybe a long MES position above 51.25. Forget the options, just go right to the micro. But if we don't clear 51.25 and we're below the low that we had earlier today at 50.78, and 3/4 before we clear 51.25, this thing is going down to 5,000. And at 5,000, we'll have a look at the price action. Not at guaranteed buy, but the technical setup right now on the daily chart is ugly. And when you scroll in and zoom into these 8-hour, 4-hour ones, we're just not making progress back above levels that we should. Ilya, I think this might be my least controversial technical take of all year, at least between you and me.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm in the money on the lower part of my SPY spread because this was actually where I wanted for this to get or thought it could get. So about 505 on SPY, about where we are now. So give or take, let's call it 50-50 on the index. Yes. So this is now key support. We clear this. I agree. We're going to maybe something like 5, maybe even a little under. And then if we can clear that, we're going to 48. Those are kind of the big levels that I see. Kind of, and then around them, there's fuzz, right? Levels are almost never exactly on the point.
I mean, so, and who's to say that the head and shoulders target that I outlined is correct? What if this is the neckline that we just broke through at 51.25? And that's very feasible given the price action that you see here, yes. How it's clearly been both support and resistance. Absolutely. This year so far. So, and that could mean that you have a setback, you know, 200 something points, 53.33, 51.25. Yeah, you're talking about a setback into the low 4,900s then. Yeah. And this is why you have to be flexible if you're a bull. The path of least resistance, technically, Dylan, I mean, it looks like it's to the downside right now. And so as a trader who doesn't have a position, I'm just trying to figure out, is the next move down here lower? Are we going to break through 50.78? Should I ride this into 5,000? Or do I have an opportunity to get long above 51.25? And until one of those two things happen, I'm certainly not going to play a range that's occurred over a 36-hour period. Right. So I'm not selling strangles between 50.75 and 51.25. I'm kind of just flat right now and waiting.
So one thing, I had this same kind of thought process yesterday with the Aussie dollar, which narrowly took out its big low, but after a very aggressive elevator down. And so I was basically racking my brain yesterday going, okay, it only broke very narrowly. It's already down so much. Do I want to chase it? And ultimately, I got short because when you break, you break, and momentum is momentum, and you have to take the price action as it presents itself. And the Aussie dollar did not bother for a meaningful correction. It just kept going. It's not down a lot today, but it's down some amount, which is more than the price that it's now lower than I sold it, not by a lot, but it is lower. And so the only thing that sort of I would bring from there to the ES SPY conversation is just because something has gone in a direction for a while doesn't mean it can't keep going. Markets don't have to retrace in a hurry. So if you're seeing key levels come down, even though there's been a significant move in their direction already, momentum is momentum and it can go, especially in a risk off move.
And the market concentration of positioning right now, right? Yeah. We did this on Off the Charts, that Friday article we do about the five most interesting sell side or buy side research pieces that come across the desk. And it was, 3 weeks ago that we highlighted the 100 percentile of long equity positioning for CTAs globally. And so this unclenching that we've seen here at the start of April is really, I think, a function of flows. I mean, we could talk about geopolitical risk all day long until we're blue in the face, and there are geopolitical risk indexes that have been starting to trade higher. But Dylan, you pointed out that oil here, with its most potent geopolitical risk factor that we've seen since the start of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it really isn't making hay up here. Mm-hmm. It feels like—
the one day where it could have made hay was Friday, before we saw the sort of a retaliation theater. It wasn't really a military act, as it was some sort of a bizarre coordinated demonstration and intervention. But the fact that it did nothing on Friday, I thought, yes, was very telling.
Well, and this, Chris, you and I were talking about this on Friday on Futures Power Hour, when we were saying, okay, if this sell-off is about geopolitics and that's the main narrative, how is it that oil isn't going anywhere, gold isn't going anywhere, the Canadian dollar, the Norwegian krone, which are oil sensitive, they're down against both the dollar and the yen. What? If this is supposed to be some sort of a Middle East, oh my God moment, why is that occurring? That didn't make sense.
That doesn't make sense. And oil prices here at $84.83 in the CLM4 contract, mind you, we've moved on from the CLK4, so we get close to expiration. It looks like that September high that we had last year seems to be some level of importance right now. Former resistance kind of holding up as support here the past week and a half. We've seen some probes on a daily basis down below 84 in that neighborhood. It was 84.5 in CLK4. It's about 84 now in CLM4. But there has been no meaningful pullback just yet. I mean, I think this is the key thing for these equity markets. We have to watch whether or not this event risk continues to evolve. But Dylan, I think selling the calls here with the 38.4 IVR, I know that oil has been correlated positively with volatility recently, which wasn't a hallmark of how the market moved higher from December onwards. But I think people need to step back and think about the logistics of how Israel would actually proceed to attack Iran. Let's say there is a retaliation coming. How would that work out? Can the Israeli Air Force simply get back and forth to Iran without some sort of significant military support? No.
No.
It can't. And the United States is not getting involved. Unlike every other year, when getting into wars is a profitable endeavor for a politician because it boosts their rating. Jingoism runs through the veins of every American. We all beat our chests, sing the patriotic hymns, and rally behind the president during a time of crisis. That's not the appetite in this political body right now. Populism is afoot on both sides of the aisle, and there's a clear anti-war impulse making its way through. So, I mean, is the United States going to jump in on the side of Israel to help them retaliate against Iran? I would say no. And if the United States is not, and Saudi Arabia is not,
by the way,
and it's been crystal
clear, we've heard it said directly.
Also, I think that's why
nobody's in the market.
All the more reason to be short oil, right?
Frankly, I think the Israelis aren't in the market for it.
Retaliation.
I think politicians are. I don't think the Israeli military is. I think Netanyahu has every incentive at the table to prolong conflict.
I'm not sure he wants a two-front war. I mean, he already has his hands full. You stretch any, and mind you, I am by no means suggesting that this would be the first strange move from this administration. But it doesn't seem to make sense. And in no uncertain terms, I mean, the message from the U.S. administration has been, listen, no, let's close this loop. So I think Dylan's right.
I suppose there's a scenario in which the Israeli government could push for this and kind of drag the United States in. But I don't know how that just then begets a scenario where the United States then is like begrudgingly providing military support. And I don't know, that just doesn't seem likely right now, given where things stand. Uh-huh. So Dylan, I mean, the lack of price action up here, if you're an oil bull, you have to think that maybe this catalyst has started to run its course. Plain and simple.
And you still have nearly a 40 IV. I mean, there's plenty of room to sell some call spreads here as much as anywhere.
You know, psychologically, I think that's actually really important for the market for oil to come back down. I know we've had a whole spiel about funny things happen when oil goes above 85, but I think it's also important to think about what happens with XLE and the broader equity market performance, because when XLE outperforms the S&P 500, the S&P 500's 12-month forward returns tend to be sideways to negative. So the fact that XLE is coming back in is probably a good sign for equity markets and ultimately oil prices coming down.
Yeah, and I mean, we just saw the consumer confidence numbers out of the U.S. on Friday. They gave us a slightly warmer reading on inflation. Much of that is almost certainly the recent rebound in oil. And of course, that gave a little bit of a unfavorable nudge to consumer confidence, which has been moving inversely of inflation of 1 year inflation expectations, I should specify, really since this whole saga with rates and beating inflation and everything like this started, since basically early 2022. So we have a situation where if you get some sort of a positive thing on oil, if oil comes in, if some of this fear of fear itself thing comes out of it, and we get back to supply demand dynamics, those supply demand dynamics do not suggest that oil needs to be up here, in my mind, because the US is awash in crude. There is no sign of meaningful disruption from these wars in actuality, because the spread between WTI and the Brent crude benchmark for Europe hasn't really gone anywhere outside the norm. So what's it doing up here if there's nothing to be theoretically afraid of?
I want to point to XLE here on the chart, because at 94.40, it doesn't seem that significant unless you take a step back and look at the daily time frame, or excuse me, the monthly time frame, 2014 highs that you have here through the November 2022 highs. This is an awful looking pin bar. So if XLE starts to underperform the broader S&P 500, that could begin to restore some confidence that ultimately this commodity rally is going to fizzle out, because it certainly hasn't yet. I know that we've seen a little bit of some sideways stepping in precious metals here, but the broader commodity complex, even so, very much holding up. Now, DBC is mostly energy products. So when you think about oil moving sideways for the past week and a half, DBC is going to be moving sideways as well. But this is the big problem. This is what sparked Jerome Powell to say what he said today, Ilya. Powell came out 1:30 p.m. Eastern, the market smacked lower. Why? The Fed does not see the path forward on inflation that it was hoping to, plain and simple. Yep. Rate cuts may not be
here. He owned it today. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was really interesting also where he said it, because he was in Canada, and he was talking with Tiff Macklem, the Bank of Canada governor. They were on a panel, and they were talking about the differences of why Canada is in comparatively worse shape economically, and why beating inflation has cost them growth and it hasn't cost U.S. growth. And why inflation has been more stubborn in the U.S. Meanwhile, it's come down quite sharply in Canada. And Powell was, I mean, he was very direct, essentially saying, like, we are not in the same boat. We can very clearly see that our growth is stronger and our inflation is stickier, and we're not going anywhere until that's not what's going on.
Canada's inflation picture is very different than that of the U.S. But
I'm short the Canadian dollar, by the way, as for the past, since Friday.
Yeah, they're 1 month, 3 month, 6 month annualized inflation rates from the BOC's perspective, when you looked at like trim mean, are all below, at or below 2%. So it's a different rate cut cycle than you're looking at in the United States here. But I mean, is this the acknowledgement that the market needs to think that the Fed is sober? It has its eyes on the steering wheel, or eyes on the road, right? That it acknowledges now, it's not just saying, yeah, rate cuts are appropriate later this year while inflation goes back up. Is this more appropriate for them to be saying this?
I mean, it makes sense, right? Because what the Fed has been saying the entire time is, we are committed to returning inflation to 2%. We have a baseline outlook. Until there is a reason to change it, there won't be a reason to change it. So what they did in March, ostensibly, wasn't them saying, we need to cut despite a warming economy. They came out and said, we upgraded growth and inflation because data was already hotter. Let's see how it comes out next. Well, now they've had three hot CPIs. Where do you go now? They've always told us they would pivot if it was stuck.
The market, though, was... as long as we were in that whole, the next rate cut, the first rate cut is six to 12 weeks away, fine. Now the fact that the Fed is telling us that the rate cut may not be here, what's to like about bonds at these levels? When we look at what's going on here in the bond market, there are still rate cut odds on the board for 2024. If the Fed is telling us that it's possible we don't get any cuts, doesn't the market need to go to a place where that's the median expectation? Where like we should be pricing in one, and therefore shouldn't the bond market remain under pressure? I've had a miserable time trading this, obviously, being long last week. But the sell-off doesn't feel like it's done. And vol's not that high comparatively. It's only 43.3 right now, IVR. Are either of you trying to bottom fish down here?
I am with you on the idea that what we need to be doing is looking for an opportunity to buy here, because I think that ongoing risk aversion will be something that invariably goes into the long end of the curve. And that what this will do is it will see bonds go up, not because the Fed is doing X, Y, Z thing, but just because there's risk aversion and because capital is going to liquidity and safety. And that's the long end when it comes to bonds. But there's no evidence in my mind to say this is an actionable idea here and now, because nothing about this says it's turning.
Would you rather buy the bond or the dollar tomorrow morning? On the dollar, same, on the same
dollar,
dollar. It's really the same thinking, right? Long dollar,
right.
Long bond, long dollar is fewer rate cuts later, as opposed to more rate cuts sooner, one way or the other.
Yes, and in fact, I am long dollars. I've been long dollars for a while. The reason I would rather buy dollars than bonds at this point is because I think where we are on dollars is, if it's a risk on market, if the market basically decides, look, fine, fewer cuts, but for good reasons, the economy isn't falling apart. It's stronger than everybody expected. I don't think that's how they're going to think, but let's say they do.
You're saying fewer cuts because of a strong economy, not fewer cuts because of too much inflation.
Exactly. And that the reason inflation is sticky is not bad reasons. They're strong economy reasons. And if those are the reasons, okay, fine, we'll survive higher rates. That's just wider yield differentials in the dollar's favor. And then if it's risk aversion, then it's a different dollar. Mm-hmm. And with the bonds, you don't have that kind of a all-weatherness to them.
But is there anything other than fewer rate cuts later that's dollar favorable?
Absolutely. So the thing I'm going to talk about in detail on macro money right after this is the widening of the yield differentials, not only because the U.S. is setting up to cut less, but because everybody else is setting up to cut more. One of the things that's been happening is rate cut odds for the ECB, the Bank of England, all the other major central banks have fallen away to some extent with what's happened in the US, because the US really is the pace setter for global yields, because the dollar is the pace setter for all global transacting in almost anything. So when the costs of borrowing dollars go up or down, the costs of borrowing in general everywhere go up or down. But now, overnight, we're going to get some input from the UK. We saw this movie last week from the ECB. When we actually got some local color out of Europe, the markets went, okay, yes, it's the Fed that's the dog wagging everybody as the tail. But when you get local color, you have to make those adjustments. And the ECB, very clearly, is going to cut more. And the euro got hosed. I think the British pound might be the next one in this continuum, where you get weak CPI overnight, and then markets go, yeah, okay, things have moved in a more hawkish direction, but for Fed reasons, whereas locally, they're going to want to cut more, and the pound is going to get hosed.
Just a case of the rest of the world outdubbing the Fed.
Yeah.
At this point in time, because if you look everywhere else, I mean, Eurozone, UK, Canada, like the rate cut odds or number of rate cuts priced in by each central bank, they've basically been moving in lockstep over the course of the year. The only divergence that you see is with the Fed. But Powell's acknowledgement, I think, that the Fed sees inflation as a problem that has not yet been defeated is actually a good thing psychologically for the market longer term. I mean, immediately, not good for bond prices. It hasn't been good for equities today. But I maintain that one of the hallmarks, one of the backbones of the rally in 2023 was the fact that even though inflation was high, the market felt like the Fed understood its job.
Yeah.
And for the past few weeks, it's felt like the market has been looking into this wedge where the Fed's telling us everything's fine. Rate cuts are still coming later this year. and you look to DBC and you see oil prices and you look at inflation expectations and you drive by the pump and it's like, hold on a second here, this doesn't make sense. And now the Fed's finally acknowledged, yes, the job is not done. Rate cuts later this year may not be appropriate. And so that means we're still focused on every single data release, because the inflation path forward, we can't get to where the Fed wants us to be unless we rattle off the 0.0, 0.1, 0.2% month over month readings for several months in a row. And we've been averaging 0.3 over the past 6 months. So we can't, you know, something's got to change. And it's just not there yet. Ilya, last week we talked about how for a second stab and as much time, we try to take a short euro put spread position. And it seemingly worked out a little bit on Thursday when vol started coming out of the market and the euro was pinned there.
Yeah.
And then Friday I had to cut it when we cleared out Thursday's low. So last week was a miserable week for me. I'm not standing in the way of the dollar again right now. I'm not trading the yen, although I think that you maybe still.
Didn't you do that euro trade? If you go back to the other chart, yeah, I thought you hit it perfectly, actually, back right where your cursor is. You went in there and you got long the euro. It came back around.
But then I got long. I took profit and it fell back. And I said, okay, we're back at support and vol's high.
And then, but did you get involved again or no? I missed the.
Oh, no, I did get involved the second time. Yeah. It's the second trade that didn't work out.
Got it.
Yeah. So first one did, second one did not. The one thing that I've been staying away from, because it's been such a monster to me this year.
Yeah.
Has been the yen. And I'm waiting for some signs of technical basing.
I let my call spread expire, essentially.
Yeah, I see.
And I've taken my hands off. Now, I think we're getting to crazy levels, but it's got to start to bounce, I think, in order for the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance to want to lean in. They've been talking. They've been saying all manner of things.
Almost every day.
Every day. The Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance, probably the most communicative of the policy makers around the major economies. They say something almost daily. And so they came out yesterday, the day before, saying, we're studying this. These are crazy levels. We don't like this kind of speculatively driven whatever. They don't like to fight markets. They figured this out, if memory serves, right after the 08 financial crisis, when, of course, the yen was surging because everybody was unwinding short yen carry. And there was massive risk aversion, and the yen really soared. And they tried their kind of classic move of taking a giant money hose and trying to fight it, and they failed and failed and failed. And so they figured out at some point, if memory serves, in 2010, that it's much better to let the markets kind of run themselves ragged, to exhaust themselves, and to start to correct a little, and to open the spigots then. So I think where we're looking at now is maybe the CPI data later in the week. Japanese data has been doing much better relative to forecasts, basically since the beginning of the year. You get a hotter CPI number and markets go, maybe the BOJ gives us another 10 basis points this year, maybe 20. And then the yen comes off the mat a little. That's the intervention risk. That's where I think maybe they go and they lean in.
I agree completely. I think that the BOJ and the Ministry of Finance have shown the proclivity in the past to intervene, not just at extreme levels, but when the winds start blowing at their back. I don't think it's a coincidence that we started getting those, will the BOJ change its policy rumors back in early December after Treasury yields had started coming off the board while oil prices were declining.
Sure.
Right? They have the wind at their
absolutely
back. Right? Japan's a country that imports over 90% of its energy still. So it's very sensitive to the fact that when the yen weakens or oil prices go up, they have to convert more of their currency to US dollars in order to pay for that energy. So higher oil prices can be a downward pressure on the yen, which has seen its terms of trade remain under significant pressure really ever since the start of the Russian war against Ukraine. So if we're really thinking about intervention risk here, if people are saying, I'm going to take a flyer, a small, you know, 6J position, maybe a long call spread, but here at these levels, maybe a short put spread. It's not so much the technicals in this chart I would be watching for. I'd be watching to see, does oil get below 84 comfortably? Do yields back off? Does a two-year get away from 5%? And once those conditions are in place, that's when this intervention talk from the BOJ Ministry of Finance can really be taken credibly. Because right now, if they were intervening tonight, Ilya, like if I'm long, yeah, I'm going to make some money. But you know what I think every trader on the planet would do? They pile in back short yen. Yeah. They would use the opportunity to get the better level and say, oil's still up, yields are still up. Thank you for the gift. I will take those pips every day of the week.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I think that's exactly,
right. At the beginning of the year, both of you were the one consensus with both of you was long.
Yeah, yet. Wrong.
Coming out of this, I'm not
wrong.
I'm not bringing it up to break balls. I'm curious.
What you should though.
What's your insight though? For what did you believe that did not occur?
I think all of what I believed still holds, and the market has not decided that it wants to care. And as the great Ira Harris said, and as I quote him forever more since I read it in a book back in, I think, 04, 05, if you're right at the wrong time, you're wrong. So it is still the case that there is only one major central bank that's not cutting rates this year, and that's Japan. All of the other central banks will still have their yield differentials move in to the yen's favor. FX markets are governed by yield differentials, ultimately. This will, I think, still work at some point, but when that point is, I'm not going to fight it.
Dylan, I'll address what went wrong with the call, right? Some of the tenets of the call were the idea that the Fed would ultimately cut rates, the BOJ would normalize. But the external factors, at least the exogenous risk to it, were that energy prices go up, that the Fed isn't able to cut when it wants to. Mm-hmm. And what have we seen this year? Like the initial pullback, okay, we go from 6.5 cuts priced in at the end of December to 3. I could see 3. I was optimistic on the path of inflation coming to 2024. And since then, oil prices have gone up. The Fed looks like they're not going to cut as much. Commodity prices are charging higher. So the things that I was expecting to happen that would filter through into or leading into a stronger yen, they just never met. And now we're looking at 1 to 2 cuts priced in, when realistically the market probably should be thinking about just one. And again, if I was Fed chair, given the data that I've seen recently, I would very strongly consider raising rates on May 1st. Just send the signal to the market. An equity correction from here will be less painful than one that comes in a year from now if the Fed whistles past the graveyard, right? Reinflation trade is very possible still. But if the market sees a Fed that's not raising rates or even thinking about doing it while inflation pressures rise, the crash is going to be a lot harder on the other end. So it's better to take the medicine now and talk tough early than to have to pay the consequences later. This is not a do as you please and ask for forgiveness later situation.
Yeah.
And that's why this is important what Powell did today. This is actually, I think, longer term, a good thing. The market has a little bit more confidence on the margin today in the Fed than it did yesterday. Forget about the price action.
Yeah. I mean, it's very simple for the yen. I mean, it's been moving inversely of global yields for ages and decades. And that's because it yields nothing. So if you look at really what started the big sell-off in the yen, going all the way back to November of 2020, it was the start of this idea that global easing had reached an apex, where basically the Fed was like, okay, I've given you open-ended QE. This is, by the way, still the tail end of the COVID response. And it was right around the second half of that year that the Fed said, you're not getting negative rates. You're not getting yield curve control. We gave you open-ended QE. That's it. We're done. That's where the yen topped out and has since been going lower. If you looked at fast forward to the beginning of this year, what have we seen? Hotter U.S. economic data, Fed rate cut expectations going from 6 to 3 and now to 1.5. Against that backdrop, the yen's going to have a very hard time going up. Until the market is done speculating on the Fed, which who knows when that is, sets themselves something of a guide post and says, okay, this is where rates are locked now. We think these expectations and these differentials hold relatively well. And that's where ostensibly the markets go, right, everybody's going to have their yields move in while the yen, worst case, has rates that stay. Better case, the BOJ needs to hike more and the yen has a nice, healthy rebound. But in order for that to happen, the bogey that is the Fed outlook needs to stop moving.
Dylan, you talk about madman delight trades. Gold to me seems like shorting it is a madman's trade right now. Historically speaking, you'd expect a stronger yen and lower U.S. Treasury yields to be a benefit for gold prices. Gold prices are up in an environment where the yen's weaker and yields are up. Who's to say that gold doesn't have a significantly higher floor underneath it now than it ever has before? Because what if yields drop? Wouldn't that, what if the yen rallies? Isn't that a reach for safety? Why wouldn't gold go up as well?
The other boogeyman that Victor Jones brought up yesterday was the suggestion that China is the closet buyer here that's driving.
I agree.
Well, I know someone who's been saying that for a while.
I agree. And Victor and I were talking about it on his show last week. That's, to me, that's what this is about, because I can't make any other sense of it. When I look at it and I see that yields are going higher, the dollar is going higher. That's been the story since the beginning of the year. This is not new. Stock markets have just started to respond now because, again, in my mind for stock markets, it was all about, is it risk on or risk off? And that was about, is the money going to be cheaper or more expensive later? So do I want to take risk or not? And so how far do I run the AI hopes narrative? That's really it. For the dollar, for yields, it's been a story of fewer cuts, higher dollar, higher yields all year. Why is gold suddenly jumping like this? Well, the only standout thing is that Chinese central bank reserves are growing at a ridiculous speed, 11% year on year as of the latest data, and probably picked up in the first quarter, although we haven't seen that those numbers yet. But all through 2023, the pace is ramping from quarter to quarter to quarter. I saw then, I thought, okay, well, am I the only one that's crazy? And so I went to go look around, and BNP Paribas had a report recently that basically said what China maybe wants to do, and I thought this made sense, was create a parallel settlement system outside of the dollar, not to replace the dollar because it can't. It still has to do business with the US. That's its biggest market. It still has to do business with Europe. That goes through SWIFT and is dollar settled ultimately. But it needs a parallel settlement system to deal with the likes of Russia. And they already have a SWIFT competitor through which there is no volume. But if they wanted to credibly say, hey, Europe, let's you transact with us in yuan and euro bilaterally on this other system, let's say, how do they credibly do that? They say the yuan on this system, or at least the trade flow on this system, is gold-backed. This is not the yuan that we can operate by fiat. And so maybe that's what this is.
All the more reason short gold is a madman's delight.
Yes.
Because not only are you up against a yield move or a yen move, but you're up against the boogeyman of a speculated Chinese floor.
Yes. And I did this math, kind of back of the napkin math. As of the end of last year, Chinese reserves were up to $135 billion. And in order for them to fully finance all of the trade they did with Russia, they would need to get to about 240. And at the pace of 11% year on year, and ostensibly they've picked up the pace, although we don't see the numbers yet, but it, looking at the price action, it seems like it. But at the pace of 11% year on year, they get to fully finance their bilateral trade with Russia by around the first quarter of next year. So this thing has legs. Now, obviously, I'm fudging a lot of the numbers here. If they don't just want to do Russia, that means it has longer to go. If they pick up the pace, maybe it has not as long to go. So we'll see. But it does appear to have legs. They don't appear to be done here.
China's gold accounts are only 4.3% of their official FX reserves, up from 2.9% in 2019. China has 2,235 tons of gold reserves as of the end of December last year. By comparison, the United States has 8,133 tons of gold reserves. So there's two things going on here, right, from the Chinese perspective. There's the totally innocuous, the PBOC is maturing as the Chinese economy matures and moves from the developed world to the, rather from the emerging world to the developed world, and therefore it's going to act and behave more like a developed economy central bank. It's going to do things like QE. It's going to have a higher portion of gold reserves, issuing debt, blah, 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 blah. Okay. And certainly the recent speech out of the Politburo suggests that QE is something that's coming into the purview of the PBOC. So there's that. The timing of this all has me thinking something a little bit more conspiratorial. Dylan, I said this last week. You weren't here for it, but I'll articulate it again. If I'm a sovereign that is not on good terms with the Western world, and I have considerable FX reserves spread out across the planet, and I see what just happened with Russia and how their assets were seized, I would be partial to the idea that some central banks, those not in on the party, right, they may want to reduce their fiat reserves and transition into something like gold. They may be particularly incentivized to move away from a fiat system in the event that they think that they could do something that may run afoul of the West that could provoke those sanctions and freeze those assets. And so before they get to the point where the West would even have the ability to pull that lever, they slowly begin to wind down their fiat reserves and they begin to stockpile gold. Because in the event that they get cut off from the Western...
You're suggesting that, just to cut to the chase...
Too long, didn't read. Go ahead.
China is preparing the flex to be able to take actions that would be in greater conflict with the West. And part of that preparation is reducing their global FX reserves and increasing their gold.
Perhaps. Right? Again, the innocuous...
Having the optionality.
The innocuous, most reasonable answer is that the PBOC is becoming like other central banks and it's adding to its gold reserves and it's doing more activities that may be consistent with how a developed economy central bank behaves. And then there's my totally conspiratorial point of view, which is China is doing this because they are preparing for something bigger.
I don't necessarily think that that
I don't have any evidence to that. Just the thought that bounces around in my head, given what we've seen over the past few years. And what are we doing today in Washington, D.C.? We're having conversations in the halls of Capitol Hill whether or not we should use the funds frozen from Russia. We should seize them to finance the Ukraine defense bill. So if you're China and you have your eyes on Taiwan, do you want to be in a situation where the United States government, the Japanese government, the South Korean government, the European Union are freezing your assets and sending those funds over to Taiwan in the form of military aid?
Well, and by the way, it's not necessarily the case. Like, this logic could work even if they don't actually intend to invade Taiwan. But if they want to take a vulnerability that they've now identified in looking at Russia and say, you know what? Let's reduce this vulnerability. We don't want to fight because we have to sell things to the US and the West. But we control us. We don't control them. What if they decide to have some kind of a conniption? And they decide to do something because they don't like how we're behaving in Africa, or they don't like that we're doing trade with Russia. And they're like, either you stop or. We need some sort of a level of protection. We need to defang our vulnerability here to some extent. Maybe they don't intend to actually make a move on Taiwan. I don't suspect that they do. I suspect Taiwan is better for them as a potential risk and therefore bargaining chip than a realized horrible, terrible quagmire, which is what it would be for them.
Nothing that I'm hearing says short gold here.
No, I don't think so. I think it's very, very tough. Making it the madman's delight.
Which is why it's a madman's delight. Dylan, you couldn't give me your money to short gold right now.
No. Very, very scary.
I mean, that's, I wouldn't be shorting gold no matter, this is why everyone says like, oh, look at volatility. The IVRs are so high. Well, IVR is based on the past year. Mm-hmm. And if we go to the weekly chart and we go back a number of years, there's a few takeaways here, right? And we're not going to dismiss them. Spikes in gold vol tend to not last that long. When they get spiky, it usually lasts a week or two. Here's 2020, even during the pandemic, GVZ, this is gold vol. Gold vol is only 16.92 right now, according to GVC, the gold volatility index, which is derived from the 30-day option chains in GC. So gold vol may be high because of how IVR is constructed, because it only looks back a year. If we were to do an IVR for gold over the past 10 years, we wouldn't be close to 100. Gold vol has a lot of room above it right now. Mm-hmm. And if the market looks supportive the way that it does, gold vol can keep expanding and prices can remain supported. Dylan, this, I'm going to go to the two charts here. Here's your weekly chart for gold prices going back to the highs that we have right around the pandemic. And if this is a sideways range, the target is somewhere between it's about $2,600 an ounce and somewhere closer towards 27. There's still upside room here, technically speaking. Silver prices longer term, they're breaking out of a multi-year decline right now. This goes back to the high in 2011. So I see nothing here that says this is a market that we should be looking to get short. If there's pullbacks, find an opportunity to get long, particularly silver prices, right? We get basically right up to 30. We pull back left shoulder, head, right shoulder. Any substantial pullback into like 26 or 27, I might be more bullish on silver than I would be on the S&P at 5,000 in the short term. So I have no desire to look short precious metals right now. You couldn't convince me otherwise. And Ilya, no. We don't need to talk about them being inflation hedges. This is ticker agnostic. If this was a chart of the euro or oil or the S&P, we'd say, okay, downtrend has been broken. This could be a significant breakout getting ready to gather pace.
Yep. I'm not going to try to short it. Take me on the other side of that range. Take me above that swing high at about 30 right there. That's a breakout.
This thing is going to take... Then who's to say that this isn't going to start a trek where it plays catch up? I mean, it hasn't hit all-time highs like gold has.
It very well might. For me, I think the kind of sequencing here might look like this. And I mean, I'm just guesstimating, but given how the Fed has been talking, I mean, they have a policy announcement that's coming up next month, early May. The first one, though, the next one where the forecast is going to change is going to be June. May is probably another, we'll see what's up. We're watching data. Same. If in the June announcement, you get the official tally goes down to 2 or even 1, gold gets crushed. Initially, because everything responds, dollar responds, stocks respond, gold responds, everything, correlations go to 1, it becomes a bifurcated market. It gets slammed down. That doesn't change the China story at all, and that's a buy.
Well, we saw this with CPI last week, right?
Yeah.
On the 10th, inflation. Okay, running hotter than expected, but gets the whole idea that Fed's not going to cut as much. Gold comes down for a day and then hits a new all-time high immediately the next session.
Yeah.
This change in the Fed's perspective may actually alter that paradigm because the past month and a half, it's been rising inflation expectations, the Fed telling us they're going to do nothing about it, right, and they may still even cut. And so you could see through a window, you can look through the keyhole and say, okay, real yields are going to fall in the future. And so gold is skating to where that puck's going to be, because inflation is going to go up, Fed rates are going to stay here, and that gap between the Fed funds rate and inflation is going to shrink. And therefore, that's going to be positive for gold. Okay, I can buy that story. But if the Fed is now telling us, maybe that gap's not going to shrink, maybe we're not going to cut rates, if we're going back to a neutral policy stance, that means the probability of a hike should be viewed equally as the probability of a cut. And the market's obviously not there right now. But that threshold once crossed, that's when it gets bad for gold. If gold's still in this world where price pressures are rising and real yields have the potential to go down significantly in the future because inflation expectations keep skyrocketing, and that leads to a bad economy, and therefore yields come down too, I can't argue for anything other than the long gold side right now. And I know that vol's high. I know that vol's high here in gold, but it's high relative to where it's been over the past year, not where it's been historically. And so if this vol expansion gathers pace, there is a lot of room overhead for it to continue. You could be looking at an IVR. I mean, realistically, we're at 16.92 right now. We could be looking at an IVR. You go back to the monthly time frame. Where would we be if we were trading around the levels of, well, I don't know if we can rely on that 2013 chart, but what would the IVR be if we're trading at a 30 in GBZ? Almost double where we are now. So that's the real risk here for people who are trying to short gold, particularly through the options market, that gold volatility is not expensive as it looks on the surface. So this is the madman's trade. I'm going to step away from it. And Ilya, you're right. You get a knockback from the Fed because the Fed says one cut this year. Gold, silver, you get your catalyst or a pullback. Blessing in disguise, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. That's
blessing
that's
in disguise, as far as I'm concerned. Yep. Dylan, I didn't hear a lot from you over the past week, which is much to my chagrin. So I'm curious, in your travails and travels, if there's anything that you'd like to share with us or the audience as we end these last 5 minutes. And if not, perhaps what are you thinking about now that you are back on the bear train for the rest of this week?
Well, I'm just happy to have an angle. I mean, I came into the year bearish. Oil was the only thing that worked for me. I got blown to smithereens in January and then put my hands back in my pockets and watched in February and March quite unhappily. And so I'm just happy to see that there's an opportunity for me to re-engage on the equity side. The things that are sort of still continue, and not to be a broken record, but you know, the things that also continue to pull my attention are Tesla and Apple, which are just companies that I, you know, in a fundamental sense, I would like to own. And so as they sort of continue to muddle along, they always hold my attention. Although obviously there's much of nothing in these names really for the entire year, and most certainly since March 1st. And so I continue to return to oil, which is the only thing that's paid me this year. I like the oil short, as I mentioned a little earlier in the show, particularly because of its non-response to the retaliation theater, even before we knew it was going to be theater. And I'm happy to see that there's an opportunity to press across the board on the equity side to see if I can eke out a little something in terms of the losses that I incurred on the wrong side of the equity market at the outset of the year. The longer this goes on, the more it seems to me that rate cuts are drifting into 2025, which I know is not what the market is saying yet. But as rate cuts drift into 2025, that has to be equity negative, just a more higher cost of capital over more time. And so I actually am hopeful that we'll get ourselves into a few months of selling here from a trading perspective, both up with declines in oil and declines in the equity market. And the only other thing that I look at that I wish that I owned that I don't own, that I feel like I should have been smart enough to own, but it wasn't smart enough to own, is copper and that FCX chart, both on the, for a bunch of reasons, but the copper, I had no reason to feel like I should have owned equities other than when you told me to go apeshit and I should have listened to you. Next time you send me an apeshit text, I will pay attention. but I had no, you know, no reason to own that. But I did have reason to at least consider a copper position, which went nowhere. But I think that the big adjustment that we're coming up on here is no rate cuts in 2024, which also gets the Fed off the hook politically.
Maybe with a certain portion of the population. I would point out the SR3M4 contract right now is still pricing in an 18.8% chance of a 25 basis point rate cut in June at the end of the trading day today. Do we think that those odds need to get zeroed out? If so, does the SR3M4 contract need to move lower? Because quite frankly, if we think that there are no cuts coming in the first half of this year, there's still a little bit of juice to be squeezed before these contracts can settle in the place that actually corresponds with the appropriate Fed funds rate at that time. So if the Fed's really serious about, you know, we get another bad month of inflation data, forget September, as far as I'm concerned. If they couldn't make the decision a few months ago when they had 6 months, when they had 8 months of good data in their back pocket, why would they turn around and say, well, we just had 4 months of bad data. Oh, now here's one good one, time to cut. That doesn't jive at all. So
if you look at where it's priced in now, just looking at the month contracts in Fed funds, November. The first cut is November.
So yeah, September right now has a... Yeah, I see September still, but that's a question that we're going to have to talk about tomorrow.
That's a, yeah.
Overtime
is out of time. The reason you probably see that is because my calculus just looks at the monthly quote, and there's adjustments you make to the probabilities to get it tuned to the day of the meeting, which is frankly math that I'm not doing.
Well, with that, we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, as always, here on Tasty Live every Monday through Thursday after last call, 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 Central. For the man in orange, Ilya Spivak, and the man in blue, Dylan Radigan, I've been Chris Vecchio. We'll see you tomorrow. Good luck trading. Stick around. Macro Money is up next, and I'm with Victor Jones on The Price of Truth later today. Be sure to check it out. Good luck trading.
See you there, everybody.
The content of this podcast is created, produced, and provided solely by Tasty Life, Inc. and does not represent the direct views or opinions of any of its affiliated companies. This content is for informational and educational purposes only. It is not, nor is it intended to be, trading or investment advice or a recommendation that any security, futures contract, digital asset, other product, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any person. Trading securities, futures products, and digital assets involve risk and may result in a loss greater than the original amount invested. Tasty Live Inc., through its content, financial programming, or otherwise, does not provide investment or financial advice or make investment recommendations. The information provided may not be appropriate for all investors and is provided without respect to individual investor financial sophistication, financial situation, investing time horizon, or risk tolerance. Tasty Live Inc. is not a licensed financial advisor, registered investment advisor, registered broker-dealer, or registered interest.